Colonel Cormac, Reel 24. I was asking about the strengths of patrols that you sent out when, and you were saying that you patrols went out looking for vehicles or looking for
Other things. They were vehicle mounted smaller
ones.
Occasionally you patrolled a country area which you would require a bigger number, like a troop. But usually it was based on section or less. And again, a roadblock on the motorway would demand much more men than an ordinary roadblock. Which we did a lot. And then that was about the we didn't do patrolling in the streets at all as such, not which was mostly done in Belfast, I think, showing the flag. Interestingly enough, when we first went to Belfast, we would go to an area that we were, from the map, was told this was a Catholic area. We were made very welcome because they felt at that time we were there to protect them against Protestant hooligans or whatever. I think the Protestants thought that we were there on their behalf, whereas we were strictly to maintain the peace. So both sides had a slightly misguided view as to why we were there originally. But those views coalesced. But that was not often that we went into Belfast for any length of time. It was usually like the helicopter operation at the Divis Flats, in an operation and out again. The other times we went in was the days of the annual parades, the Orange Parades. And it was usually then we were given a sector of the planned route to man and secure. And that involved quite a length of thoroughfare through Belfast, sealing off the side roads, particularly when the marching route brushed up against a Catholic area. And your idea was then quite clearly to make sure the marchers kept to their prescribed route, and secondly, that the Catholics didn't interfere with the marchers unduly or by, even worse, by throwing petrol bombs or stones at them. So that demanded quite a lot of planning, getting the troops moving out to the right parts of the road, spreading out, having your concertina wire ready, and sealing off areas that would likely be troublesome. And then you might be there for some considerable time before the march took part, and then after it finished, you waited for a bit before clearing up. But those were the main occasions that we did go into Belfast. Otherwise, it was Lurgan, Lismore, Portadown, and then South Armagh.
Did you keep the same squadrons in the same locations all the way through?
Yes, they were.
Or did you rotate them?
Yeah. Four squadron was done at Newry, five squadron based on Gosford, 4-2 squadron stayed with us in Longkesh, and first squadron were at Portadown. And they stayed in the same base all the time. I think it was mainly so they would be familiar with the area in which they were operating, and so that, where possible, they could achieve a working relationship with the local police.
What about relations with the local civil population? Did you manage to get on reasonable terms with any of the locals in any of the squadron areas?
Not really. Some areas it was easier to move around than others. At one time, Portadown was quite peaceful. Since then, of course, there have been some notorious flash-ups and route marches in Portadown to various churches and things through Catholic, which have caused enormous trouble.
The Garvachy Road dispute.
Exactly so. We didn't have much of that at that time. And in fact, I think I was able to go down to a tailor in Portadown and buy a length of tweed and have a suit made up. That was almost as normal as that. That was slightly unusual, yeah. Certainly it wouldn't happen in Newry. Gosford, again, you had to be fairly careful. You were out in the country a bit more. So they all had a wide variety, but the idea was to leave them where they were and get so used to where the countryside they had to operate in and become quite familiar with that.
Did you suffer any casualties while you were there?
One or two people hit at roadblocks and damaged slightly. Nothing, I'm happy to say, terribly seriously. I think that again, you see, about the time we were there, the Criminal Injuries Compensation Acts came through, when theoretically any of our troops injured in a roadblock or other operation could claim damages. But I don't think any of our chaps who were knocked down like that ever successfully claimed damages. It's easier to say that you might be eligible than to actually get the money. We had one chap killed, and that was a tragic accident.
What happened to him?
He was shot by one of our own people.
Was this a negligent discharge?
Yes. Down at Gosford, a chap out on patrol at night, and this guy was standing at a window. And for the reasons that you never really understood, this chap's rifle went off and just, of course, caught this chap and killed him, which was absolutely tragic. But that was the only fatality we had.
What could your chaps do when they were off duty? Was it safe for them to go out into the area in which they were operating, or did they have to remain inside their accommodation?
We were generally confined to barracks, to use that phrase. Mm-hmm. There were some places where it was thought that you could go to a disco and be safe, but we didn't. We didn't allow that. Mm. People were really kept strictly, and of course, once or twice people broke bounds, and they were caught and severely dealt with, because we felt that it was much better not to be involved, and there was no possibility of someone being led astray and lured out to another area where they could be disposed of, because these things did happen. So we discouraged that actively. And so what could we do? Well, one of the highlights was a visit by Acker Bilk and his band.
The Temperance Seven.
They were extremely good. I knew them because Acker Bilk did his national service in the Sappers. He claims that he learned to play in the guard room in the regiment in the Canal Zone. I could well believe it. I had met him years ago in Berlin when he came out to do a concert for the BOR radio thing, and we had about a 3-hour concert in one of the halls in Berlin, which they then reduced to half an hour for the broadcast. And then we entertained him and his band to our mess in Berlin afterwards. And could they pack it away? Yes, they did. So when he came to Ireland, that was great. And we went up and met him again, and he gave a tremendous concert for us and came back to the sergeant's mess afterwards. We had to be extremely careful about security in the concert hall. With the local police and so on. That was all planned, and people got there and back safely. But there were not many occasions when that sort of entertainment occurred. ENSA didn't operate. It wasn't an easy place for them to operate, because you were so worried about their security that it was more trouble than it was worth.
Did this confinement constraint cause any problems with discipline and morale? And
only for those who broke bounds and they were caught. Mm. And I simply, because I was CEO at that time, and I just went down and dealt with them summarily and fined them the maximum. Mm. I said, I'm not going to do anything more because I need the working numbers and you're here to work. But the lesson is you're going to suffer a financial penalty. And that was my approach to all those incidents, and I think it seemed to work anyway, and it was seemed to be fair.
I mean, it's often said that one of the great difficulties in counterinsurgency operations is that most of the time the soldiers are living under very serious restrictions on their normal freedom of action, and yet there's nothing happening, and this creates a tendency for them to become somewhat slack, and then something does happen and it turns into a tragedy. So there is always a difficulty in maintaining the level of alertness.
Yes, that's why we organise the programme of operational matters like patrols at night, roadblocks all around the clock and so on.
Keeping them busy.
Keeping them busy. Mm. We did offer them, there was a possibility of 2 or 3 days R&R, rest and recuperation. The Isle of Man was possible. Mm. Going back to England was not really a starter for the time available. Although it was an option that was offered, it wasn't taken up, and there were some places on the coast in staunchly Protestant areas where they would be safe to go for a couple of days. A few of them took advantage of that, but not that many, and I certainly declined. I thought that was the wrong for me to go away in a few days, and so I didn't bother, and I think that was better. And when I had a free moment, I would pound round the airfield at Longcash, keeping fit. The other thing that I discouraged was any drinking. I said we'll be as teetotal as we possibly can, so that no one could ever point the finger and say, "I smelt drink on that chap, and this is what happened, and he was unfit for duty." There were people who would try and take advantage of any situation like that and put the blame and so on top of you. And by and large, that situation was maintained. Mm. A quiet drink in the mess in the evening, possibly, but I just made the rule not to have one.
Mm. How long were you actually out there for altogether?
It was about March to August. About 4 or 5 months, and I had been with the advance party and the reconnaissance before that, so it was probably for me nearer 6 months. And that in itself was quite long enough to keep that sort of pressure up. I was told that when we came off the plane back into Hanover, where we flew into, that we all looked about as tired as we possibly could, but we didn't notice that at the time. We were just glad to be back.
What were you told about the purpose of your deployment there when you were on the advance party in the recce? Do you remember what your instructions were? And who did they come from? Was it HQ Northern Ireland at Lisburn?
Yeah. Yeah. Basically, to keep the peace. Mm. They explained the situation, which some of us, like myself, were perfectly aware of the Irish troubles, over a great deal of time, over historical periods. And when I talked to the regiment before we went out, I said, "We're going out to hold the peace, keep the situation stable, to discourage extreme violence on either side, and give the politicians a chance to sort things out." I said, this was 1970-71, let's take the long view. It'll take them at least 10 years to sort it out. Well, I was wrong by a factor of 3. 30 years later, they still haven't got it sorted out. Mm. But that was the sort of general view that I took, that's what we were there, to give the politicians the chance to sort out a very complex historical problem. We had talks. I got people along to give a lecture or two on Northern Ireland, why it had happened, as far as people could tell. I got a policeman across, a superintendent, a chief superintendent, I think, to address us all and say what the Ulster Constabulary felt about it and what they were doing and so on, so that they would have some idea of the organisations involved, what the situation was, and really adding to what I said about being there.
And you said that the Irish soldiers in the regiment all functioned perfectly effectively as soldiers in the regiment.
Absolutely.
How did the English soldiers take to this business? Because presumably the sources of the troubles in Ireland would all be something quite new and unusual to them.
I think most of them certainly had an idea that there always had been troubles in Ireland. I mean, not many knew back to Wolfe Tone, not many knew back to Elizabethan times, to the Pale, and what that meant. But a lot of them were aware of 1916 and the fight for Irish independence, the story of Michael Collins and so on. They were vaguely aware of that, and that it took a lot of effort from World War I to this trouble in our backyard. So they had vague ideas about that, but not too many knew in detail. Mm. But we did our best to clarify it as best we could.
Were they interested in the political issues?
Not very. They were just interested in what they had to do and getting it over with and getting back to Germany to proper soldiering, or to use a phrase, and their families.
What happened then once you got back to Germany with the regiment?
We went on leave. We had, I don't know, a couple of weeks leave or so. And that was fine. That was just what we wanted. Sort the place out and then have some leave and then get back into the routine for the next training season. Yeah. The only niggle that we had was actually going to Ireland. When we came from Germany, we flew in. The main body flew in, and they were taken to pieces by the customs. All the duty-free cigarettes and this and that and the other, they were confiscated. It left a very nasty taste in our mouths. Going to our own country to help sort out a situation, and the customs behaved like that. That was something that most of us would never forgive.
Was there anything you could do about that?
Nothing. No. We just had to grin and bear it. Typical governmental civil service mentality. Never thought. Coming in, let them bring all the booze and cigarettes they can. Not that they were able to drink very much, or carry very much, but the cigarettes were perhaps the most important thing. That was, I thought, unforgivable. But there we were. That's what happened. The grateful government organized it for us. By the time we got back home and went and leave and then got back, we'd almost forgotten. We produced a journal, a paper, sort of softback, A4 size thing, for the information of our chaps and people at home, what we were doing. That went on. We didn't have much time for anything else.
How long did it take you to get back into the normal swing of things and after this interlude in Ireland?
Well, after we had our leave, we came back, and then we just got the vehicles, our APCs, out of store. There was a rear party that had turned the engines over and done the usual things. We just settled down and then started sending people on training again on courses and did a few local exercises, got back into our emergency and move out of barracks and BOR to our allotted areas, practiced all that, and gradually got back into the routine again, and ready for the next exercise season. They're very adaptable soldiers, they really are. They were just happy to be back in BOR and getting on with things.
When you were commanding the regiment, when you were 2IC of the regiment, when it was in Germany, what was its war role? What would it have done had there been an order to crash out?
We were in support of 11th Armour Brigade. And that was the brigade headquarters in which I sat and operated with the brigade major. And it really was. 1st Division was divided into two, 7th Brigade in the north, 11th Brigade in the south, half the divisional area. And we had, our job was to know all the river and gap crossings that were required in the area, know where all our obstacles had to be laid or planned to be laid, all our minefields and demolitions. We had to know where all our mines and explosives were stored. We had to make sure we knew how to get them out of the store at the right time and organize the transport to get them to the right place at the time. Those were the sort of things that we worked on and practiced for our GDP role, General Deployment.
And what would 11th Armoured Brigade have done? Would they have been involved in screening, or would they have been involved in counterstroke in the event of the balloon going up?
Any counterstroke would have been a reaction to what was happening. There wasn't much in the way of a plan for that. The plan was to hold our brigade area and making sure we were lined up with 7 Brigade.
Yes.
But we had to know our area so well that we knew what all the obstacles would be, where the likely spots would be, where the built-up areas were that we might have to fight round or through.
Were they thinking in terms of a positional defence or a mobile defence at that stage?
It was a bit of both, really, but the main thing was the minefield and demolition plan.
For you, that would have been the main thing,
That was the key thing.
Yeah. I mean, did you have a lot of demolitions?
Yes.
Pre-wrecked and pre-arranged?
A lot of that. And it got more sophisticated as time went on. I mean, all the autobahns were very difficult to block. So means were devised to have holes in the autobahn surfaces where we could then slot in huge steel girders that would be very difficult even for a heavy tank to flatten down, abutments of bridges to bring them down to block autobahns. All these things happened, and we practiced those. And those were the bridge demolition techniques we used to practice a lot on our local bridges round about. We did all our river crossing training at Orr Park, down near Hamlin, where we used to have bridging camps. So we were all the time training for those roles, and the operational plan. Well, those in the know had to know where it was and how it worked. Obviously, we couldn't practice outloading very often. It was a rare occasion when we could outload all our mines and explosives. But we worked very closely with the RASC, RCT, as it became, and so on, where these and how we would get them there, and the transport. There's a lot to think about. And, of course, the GDP, the General Deployment Plan, used to change quite regularly. It didn't change in my time, but it changed shortly afterwards. Because after all, how could a divisional commander make his name by practicing the same plan that his predecessor Buck 10 had done? So everyone, corps commanders and the like, had their little say in tweaking or modifying or altering the GDP. And often there was the flavor of the month. There was the tripwire philosophy. Should we preempt by attacking, or what about nuclear weapons?
Did the development of tactical nuclear weapons have implications for your...
Yes, it did. We were particularly concerned with the ADMs at the time, the atomic demolition munition, which were all in American hands. We had a plan where they would all be, assuming we got them, and where we would use them. We practiced with the American teams. We practiced moving up dummy ADMs because they were heavily escorted under American control. And then they would come in and there was a takeover point where we would help with the security and guide them to the right site. I mean, for the sake of example, they all looked like 40-gallon oil drums. So we had to move those around and put them in the right place under secure conditions and so on. That was our involvement in the nuclear weapons business. They were never used, of course, thank goodness. But there were some occasions when they were thought to be the only way to block some particular place.
While you were there any invasion scares, any times when you were alarmed?
No. Not that we knew of. I mean, certainly... from my Bricksmith side of things, I knew what the indicators were, but there was never a situation that we were told about that 19 Motor Rifle Division have moved out and are coming down the Helmstedt Autobahn. That didn't arise. There may have been scares and threats, but they were at a level way above us, and they obviously didn't come to anything. So we never had to crash out except on practice to our emergency deployment plan.
When you did do a practice crash out, roughly how long would it take you to get the regiment as a whole on the road and moving to their locations?
Well, from the time that people were called out of barracks, assuming it happened at night, we could be in our deployment locations an hour and a half. Mm. Had to be quick. Yeah. It was all keyed up. Everything was sorted out, and every vehicle had a pre-loading plan, and everyone in charge of the vehicle had a board, and they would be able to quickly tick, tick, tick.
The only question everything was on.
Everything was required. That you knew exactly how many men you have, because one or two would be in courses, one or two would be in leave. But allowing for that, you could get out PDQ. That was the essence of it.
You mentioned people going back on courses, going backwards and forwards. Did this have a disruptive effect on?
Not really. The number you allowed for that. You didn't send people away in courses on the main exercise season.
Yes.
You chose the quiet period because it was geared up to individual training, either in BOR or at home. And then it was low-level formation training, and then it became
worked up to the big
maneuvers. Worked up to the divisional exercises, and occasionally a core exercise. But mostly we were interested in one division, Eternal Triangle, which was the divisional sign, and that was the name of the exercise. Yeah. Mm. And we would do a brigade exercise, and so would 7 Brigade, and Eternal Triangle basically got our 2 brigades working together. Mm. That's about it.
Who was the brigade commander while you were?
I had two interesting characters. And I'm just trying to think. My first one was Tiny. He was very good. His name will come. he's dead now, poor chap. But he was an old-fashioned sort of stickler for getting things absolutely right. And if you didn't have your respirator and your thing properly, you were in trouble. But he was clearly an outstanding soldier and was respected for that. He also became an expert on internal security operations. He had been, he went to command the division after us. He was then in Ireland.
Not Frank Kitson?
No, it wasn't Frank Kitson, not a bunch of five. He was a brigade commander in Berlin, in Belfast when I was there. Mm. Oh, it'll come, Tiny. Oh, he was a great chap, and did very well. But sadly, he died. He was a large man. I think that may have affected things. But he was good, in a different way. A chap called Rob. The next one was Robin Carnegie, who finished up military secretary. He was a more methodical, staff-orientated man, but he was a good soldier too. I liked him very much. Very efficient, very demanding. His brigade major, who is a great friend of mine, is Peter Inge. That was the sort of quality we had. Mm. I'm seeing Peter for dinner next month. Lord Inge now. And we had a very high grade staff. Both David Sands, the previous brigade major, he was outstanding, but Peter Inge was tremendous. And he and Robin Carnegie formed a very formidable team.
Did the brigade run to a certain routine, the brigade headquarters? Did they start the day with morning prayers and then go on from there?
What exercise, you mean?
Yes.
Yes, that's right, and see, we were part and parcel of it. But all the time, we had a close working relationship with the brigade, and indeed the division. Mm. We went both ways. I used to go down to Minden quite a lot, and we did a lot of training, and so much of it were organised at brigade level. I should say that Robin Carnegie was intensely interested in what tactics the Soviet Army would use.